Welcome back to the Global Research News Hour. This is Michel Chalcedovsky from Montreal, Canada. Our website is www.globalresearch.ca. The program is an initiative of the Center for Research on Globalization. Our next guest on this program is Michael Parenti, distinguished author and scholar, researcher, who is based in California. Michael is an internationally known award-winning author. He's lectured all over the United States. His writings have been translated into several foreign languages. I should mention his website, which is his website is michaelparenti.org, where you can also order his books. I've known Michael for quite a number of years now. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Hello, Michel.
Good to talk to you live.
I guess we're in a
very serious crisis right now. It's a social, political, economic crisis. There's a war in the Middle East. There's homeland security in the United States and Canada and around the world. And there's an evolving impoverishment of people around the world due to a number of factors, but also increasing, rising food prices. How do you view this evolving crisis?
Well, you've said it all already. Said better than I can. Yeah, the world food prices have increased 77% apparently, and that's probably with the basic food supplies, rice and wheat and corn and the like. I view this not just as a natural development, and I view it not just as something, you know, that happens stochastically by chance. They've been working very hard to move toward a greater impoverishment. By they, I mean the large international global financial interests are very much interested in rolling back the gains, the democratic gains that have been made by people in any number of countries in Europe and North America. And so what we're getting is a growing impoverishment of the working populace and a growing super enrichment of the already super rich. In the U.S., the income gap is now wider than it's been. It's wider now than it was in 1929 on the eve of the Great Depression. They've been breaking labor unions here in the U.S., they've been jacking up prices, monopolizing markets, wiping out smaller producers and smaller distributors. They've been charging usurious interest fees for credit and the like. All of this has been leading to a growing impoverishment of people.
And I presume that the recent developments have a lot to do with the speculative move which has taken place in the commodity markets. The fact that investors, so-called investors, are speculating on it and pushing these prices up dramatically. In your last book, you focus on the issue of media manipulation. Is that correct?
Yes, that's one of, well, I mean, that's one of about 40 or 50 selections that I have in the book, yeah.
Well, that brings me to the issue of media manipulation, and also scholarly manipulation, the fact that mainstream scholars in universities and research centers, in fact, are presenting this this American order in a way which confuses people, because they still believe that it's democracy and it's based on free initiative and so on and so forth. And you unravel all that and present a world which is ultimately, one which feeds, a social inequality.
It does seem that academia is quite at home. Most of the people in academia are quite at home with the standard ideology that corporate capitalism creates both prosperity and democracy, when in fact the history shows and today's realities show something different. Most of the world is capitalist and getting increasingly capitalist. I mean, free markets, the breakdown of local protections and the like. And most of the world is poor and getting increasingly poor. In fact, the number of poor is growing, the poor are growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So poverty is spreading even as the number of billionaires are increasing, rather dramatically also. So we're getting this greater and greater pull of enormous wealth next to growing poverty. And it's not just an unfortunate juxtaposition, there's a dynamic interaction. In other words, wealth creates poverty. The Lord can't be rich unless he lives off the backs of his poor serfs, who create more value that he can consume than they, more value than they consume. And that surplus goes to the Lord. And the slave lives well off, I mean, the slave master lives well off the slaves, and the plutocracy lives well off the rest of us. We pay the taxes and we do the work, and we're getting less and less. So this myth that capitalism creates prosperity, when in fact it was the fights against the plutocracy, the fights for minimum wage, the fights for survivor insurance, unemployment insurance, pension funds, organized collective bargaining, all these fights that helped and led to some modicum of prosperity were resisted by those at the top. All the democratizing gains that were made, however febrile and however marginal they are, all those gains were resisted by the people at the top. In U.S. history, the people at the top resisted the removal of property qualifications for the vote. They resisted emancipation and abolitionism. They resisted the abolition of segregation, and they resisted the removal of property qualifications to hold office. They have resisted and still do dissenting opinions and views being disseminated in the public discourse. So to credit them with prosperity and democracy when in fact they have opposed those things have come in despite them and against their enormous and powerful resistance. And those things have been rolled back by their efforts. So we should really keep in mind that those at the top, and by plutocracy I mean, it's a Greek word, it means rule by the wealthy, those at the top have no interest in democracy, are very distrustful of it, and really hostile to it, although they pick up the idiom and claim to be its progenitors. And there's also this prosperity myth. In America, this country in the U.S., and I think it's true of Canada, it's certainly true of Western Europe, most of these countries were, through the 19th century, well into the 20th century, they had conditions that were akin to third world conditions, which was widespread poverty and underemployment and hard work and the like. What we call prosperity is something that's been principally a post-World War II phenomenon. And in the U.S., you can say from 1946 to about 1980, and then the rollback started, and it's been going downhill ever since for working people. Their real wages have declined, and job opportunities have lessened. And the great American dream, which was that a blue-collar worker could have his own home and his own car, and his kid can go to get a public education, and even up to the college level, and he could have this middle-class lifestyle, a lot of that is slipping away now increasingly as the rollback continues.
But if we look at the logic of this system, ultimately, it's also creating the seeds of its own destruction, because by compressing the wages and compressing them in such a way that people are impoverished, and if we look at it in a global context where workers, let's say in China, don't make more than $3 a day, what does this do? It backlashes on markets. It means that there's nobody there to consume the commodities which are making these people rich. Through a profit-driven system. And so what's happening, in fact, is that the consumer economy, the mass consumer economy, is in crisis, and then you have certain pockets of luxury. But ultimately, the system can't produce at slave labor, at wages which are abysmally low, and then expect that consumer markets are simply going to progress. They don't.
Yes, for a while. For a while, they can sustain that sort of thing. I mean, there is a contradiction around wages, which is wages, if I'm a boss, wages which cut into my profits have to be kept down. But wages which are needed to buy the products that my workers make have to be kept up. So ideally, what I want to do is pay my workers very little, but hope that workers elsewhere get paid enough so that they can buy the goods and services that my workers produce. But of course, the other bosses have the same idea. So after a while, you do get it. What you have is you have a backlog of savings. So that cushions the downward spiral somewhat. You have the fact that many households have been able to maintain their income level by having a second and third party within the household enter the job market. So now both the man and the woman work, and together they just manage what the man alone used to be able to do before. So people are working twice as hard just to stay in the same place. And I say, if you're working harder and harder to stay in the same place, you're not staying in the same place. You're really moving back. And then they also have their credit cards, many of which are maxed out now, and they can't. These are not sustainable things. I mean, your point is absolutely right. It's just a matter of time before this becomes, a disaster, which is already happening. We see that in the housing market.
Where do you think this is going to lead the United States and the world in the foreseeable future, given the fact that the country is also at war in the Middle East?
I think we're going to see a colossal rollback and collapse in places, collapse in the value of the dollar, collapse in consumption. People are already consuming less. I guess you see the oil industry and the corporations and such, their interest is not in selling their product. Their interest is in making money. I mean, profits is the sole thing. Profits is the soul of the system. So if they're selling less gas, but if gas is over $4 a gallon, they're making up. They're so price gouging that they're making up for the drop in consumption. They're still making more money.
we started up the program looking at poverty, at the causes of poverty, and as an economist, I always learned in my textbooks, and that's the basic fallacy, that poverty was due to scarcity of resources. But in fact, it's precisely the opposite. The more this capitalist system produces or overproduces, the more it impoverishes people around the world. Now, I think that one important aspect of this crisis today with rising food prices is, and we can reflect upon the history, but as you might recall, back in the 70s, Henry Kissinger commissioned this very important government memorandum or study, which was a National Security Council initiative, and it was entitled "Implications of Worldwide Population Growth for U.S. Security and Overseas Interests." And in that, he said, in fact, he stated very candidly, "If you control the people, if you control the food, you control the people," and that there was a deliberate process, as you suggested, to actually use poverty as to use food as an instrument of U.S. foreign policy.
Well, we certainly see that with something like Monsanto coming along and creating terminal seeds and coercing and forcing farmers to adopt their terminal seed system so that they are dependent on Monsanto. We see that with the free trade that goes on around the world, which involves agribusiness dumping products and wiping out markets, the homegrown foods and home and small but quite productive farmers in countries all around the world, from Africa to Mexico to wherever. So that the food distribution, production distribution system is becoming more concentrated and being taken out of the hands of population themselves. And yes, that does have political ramifications, that, the country becomes that much more weakened and dependent on these large financial centers.
But in fact, now the food market is being controlled by these agribusiness conglomerates because they control the intellectual property rights, and they're also impoverishing farmers all over the world. And the North American farmer as well is in the grip of the biotechnology conglomerates because they're also into pharmaceuticals and chemicals, and they're linked up with the military industrial establishment.
Right, and the one real growth area in the U.S. has been the military. It's been a spectacular growth in the military budget since George Bush came in. That budget has, if you count the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, more than doubled, and it was a huge budget as it was. There's no other item in our national budget that's more than doubled.
What is the amount now for the 2008 exercise, or let's say 2007, which is being completed?
Well, fiscal 2007, I thought it was up to $650 billion U.S. dollars for the budget, but that doesn't count the billions that is being spent on Iraq and Afghanistan, and it doesn't count the billions that have to be paid out on the national debt, which has grown since George Bush came in 2001. The national debt was a phenomenal $4.5 trillion, and it's now upwards of $10 trillion. Well, a lot of that has been driven by the enormous military spending and war-driven expenditures, and and that means the huge payout every year of our tax dollars in the form of interest on the national debt, which goes to rich creditors, that's growing and growing, and that's part of the military spending also. The conservatives in the U.S. have assiduously pursued the deficit spending. When Reagan came into office, the U.S. national debt was $800 billion, and then by the time he left, it was about $1.5 trillion, I believe. When George Bush Sr. came in, he raised it, 2.5 trillion. George Sr. came in and he raised it to about $4.5 trillion. Clinton held it steady and even produced surpluses for a couple of years. The only credit I would give him for anything he did in his presidency. But now Bush has more than doubled the national debt to almost $10 trillion. And that worked very well, which we can talk about after.
I wanted perhaps to shift the focus of our discussion to another very important issue, which has to do with His Royal Highness, the Dalai Lama, because you've written on this issue.
Michelle, can I just finish what I was saying about deficit spending in the national
budget? Oh, absolutely. Let's pursue that.
Well, these conservatives, as I say, have become the biggest deficit spenders, the wildest spenders, and it's a way of privatizing the federal budget. That is, the larger the debt, the higher is the proportion of your tax dollar that buys nothing and just goes from the hardworking taxpayer into the pockets of rich competitors, both North American and foreign. So this is why they like deficit spending. The greater the national debt, the less money there is available for human services and the like. So what they're doing is they're borrowing money from the people they should be taxing. And meanwhile, they are cutting taxes for the super rich while pursuing a war. I mean, it's the first time you've seen a government both start war spending and do major cuts in taxes to the very rich. So it's a way of intensifying the upward redistribution of income.
Well, absolutely, but I think one has to then contrast that to the kind of traditional notions of deficit spending in the Keynesian logic, where public works can lead to employment creation and so on and so forth. This is not happening in America, because the deficit spending is going to fuel the military-industrial complex, which in fact creates very few jobs, and as you say, it fuels wealth accumulation. And I mean, there's been a lot of confusion about this, in the sense that even John Kenneth Galbraith at one point said that the Reagan administration was using Keynesian economics, when in fact it was doing exactly the opposite to Keynesian economics.
That's right. It was subverting Keynesian economics. There's more to Keynesian economics than just some deficit spending. It's how the money is then used, right?
Well, absolutely. So we have to understand that deficit spending, that the neoliberals, in fact, are the most committed to, in fact, not to eliminating deficits, but in fact increasing deficits, in the sense that it enables them to pursue not only a military agenda, but also to concentrate the power of a handful of wealthy families and individuals around the country.
Right, and it's not the top 20th percent, the top quintile, the top fifth, as they like to say, the richest fifth. I mean, to be in the top 20% in the U.S., all you have to be making is over $80,000 or $90,000, which doesn't make you rich. It's not even the top 1%. It's about a fraction, less than a fourth of 1% that really own the lion's share of the wealth and income in America. And so people, when they talk about the rich, they really don't even know how rich the rich really are. The super rich is really. And John Edwards was right. He said it's not a struggle between rich and poor. It's a struggle between the super rich and the rest of us.
And I presume it's also a struggle between the rich themselves because they're at each other's throats to become richer. I mean, I was struck by the fact that Halliburton now is buying up a Citibank or Citigroup. It's a major shareholder. And so that's something entirely new where these people may have a collective spirit in the sense that they want to enrich themselves, but they are also in the process of railroading each other. And that is leading to even greater concentration of income and wealth and corporate control.
Yeah, yes, indeed. And you know, it's often been said if you wanted to get Marxist about this, that the function of the state is to protect that rich plutocratic investing class, to protect its interests, advance and increase those interests, against the demands of the ordinary populace. But I would argue there's another function to the state also, which is to protect the capitalist system from itself, that it is a self-devouring thing. We saw that in Argentina, for instance, where the investing class just simply consumed its own base to the point where the whole thing collapsed like a deck of cards. And I've often thought that the difference between the Democrats and the Republicans is that the Democrats recognize that second function also, to keep the corporate system going, whereas this particular wing of the Republican Party in the U.S., the really reactionary, totally maniacal profit-driven wing, has no interest really in protecting the system from its own predators. I mean, we've seen that happen with Enron and Halliburton and all these other things, where they're just plundering the system, and if given a free hand, they'll do the same thing again. They'll just plunder away and with all sorts of quite criminal procedures, you know, insider trading and the like. So this is what we face. We really face a high-flown kind of plunder and gangsterism at the top.
How does that tie into, let's say, organized crime? Because I've done a lot of research on the whole issue of money laundering and drugs and so on, and in fact the dividing line is oft between bona fide corporations and criminal undertakings is often very thin.
Yes, I would say one difference is that organized crime is relatively small potatoes compared to what these people at the top are doing. I mean, much of organized crime is scams and knocking off parking meters and numbers rackets and drugs at the street level or regional level. But the really big stuff, I think you've got to go to crime in the suites rather than crime.
It's done in the corporate boardrooms.
Right.
In the sense that the corporations also overshadow the criminal syndicates. I mean, the drug trade is still very important, and
yes,
it's very important for the financial system, I presume.
But most of the things that these plutocrats do are perfectly legal. I mean, they don't really go to jail for all of it, because a lot of it is just quite legal, like free trade. You know. I'm sorry, you wanted to bring up...
I was going to shift subjects, but we can do it. Again, everything is interconnected. But I was impressed by your writings on Tibet, and of course your writings on Tibet preceded the ongoing crisis when you wrote an article which we actually published on Global Research, which is called "Friendly Feudalism: The Tibet Myth." And I think this puts in perspective what's happening in China-U.S. relations and the media campaign which is being waged against the Chinese leaders using Tibet essentially as a pretext. How do you evolve? How do you view this latest development? There's been a lot of media disinformation with regard to what's going on in Tibet.
Yes, that article, by the way, an updated version of that article is available on my website. So if you go, you can at michaelparenti.org, you can see the article. It's been causing quite a stir, and a lot of people have been reading it. I get emails from Chinese readers who are actually very puzzled and very hurt by the what they consider to be the anti-Chinese sentiments that exist here in the States and in parts of Western Europe, and I imagine Canada too, to some degree. This Free Tibet, certainly in Vancouver, I just talked to someone recently, this strong Free Tibet view they feel is an attack on them. My article was not to support anything the Chinese do necessarily, but to expose that Shangri-La myth of old Tibet. Now, of course, people are quick to say, oh, we know the Shangri-La thing was just a paradise la-la view. We nobody holds to that. I'm sorry, they did. I'm sorry. Most of the people I know did hold to the idea that Tibet had something different. It was removed from the crass materialism and degeneracy of Western societies. It had a spirituality where everybody had a place and a harmony, a deep spiritual harmony. And when I looked at it, that isn't what I found. I found a feudalism in which the serfs were terribly exploited. They were taxed up one side and down the other. They were caught in debts that were passed on for generations. They were ground down into the dirt by a small class of very rich lamas and lords, both secular lords and religious lamas, the big rich monasteries, including where the Dalai Lama lived. He himself had about 100 slaves in his retinue. I mean, that's not his doing. You can't blame him. He was plugged into the system as a 9 or 10 year old boy, and he was driven into exile when he was 25. So Tibet was anything but an enviable or free society. So when you say Free Tibet, how about freeing it from its own terrible feudalism? And one thing the Chinese did do, I will say, is they got rid of the usury, which was grinding the peasants into debt. They just abolished all those debts. They got rid of this parasitic exploitative class and put them to work, which was a catastrophe, a calamity for them. I mean, it was the most horrible thing to start digging in the ground and cleaning up public areas and being put to do manual labor and being deprived of their immense wealth. The land and the grazing fields were communalized, as were the herds, and Tibetan children got an education for the first time. In old Tibet, the monks used to go around and pick out 9-year-old boys and bring them into the monasteries and raise them as servants or actors or soldiers or monks. Many of them were used for sexual gratification. I even cite the autobiography of one such monk who tells a terrible story taken from his family and the like. I mean, human rights were not very human. So a lot of things actually have improved, and I make that point, and for that I've been accused of supporting Chinese imperialism, et cetera, which I do not, and I don't. And I even have a lot of critical stuff about Chinese society and the turns they're taking and the way they've been treating their own people.
But if you put the United States and China together, certainly China may not be a model of human rights, but neither is the United States, which is involved in acts of torture, illegal detention, killing of people in Iraq and around the world. So
pursuing wars of aggression. Wars of aggression. Just as Hitler invaded Poland, we invaded the U.S. leaders have invaded countries without provocation or cause and attacked them. And I mean, Grenada, Panama, Somalia, Iraq twice, Yugoslavia bombed 78 days, day and night, without any provocation of any kind and in violation of international law, yeah. But, you know, the U.S. policy toward China is really sort of two-pronged, and I think this is what confuses these Chinese who have written to me and can't understand why the U.S. is being so critical of China. On the one hand, there's every embrace and encouragement with the Chinese as they privatize and take the capitalist road and work in the business zones where Chinese workers are working 14-hour days, 7 days a week, and all that. Why U.S. the U.S. plutocracy is hugging the Chinese real good, and they're selling us all these products and taking our U.S. dollars. On the other hand, there is an awareness that China is growing in its strength, its industrial capacity, and is potentially a threat. So there is a desire to dismember or break off pieces of it to lessen its scope and its size. The same thing with Russia, welcoming the Russians into privatization and the free market, but then meanwhile giving encouragement to Chechnya to break away and other countries that have already broken away from what was once the Soviet Union. So
now the same thing is happening in China, because right from the outset in the early 50s, the United States, and coupled with CIA activities, has supported secessionist movements in Tibet, but also in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, and so that's right. The whole western frontier of China. They've also contemplated the possibility that Guangdong, the province of southern China, should separate from China. So that this idea of balkanizing China is nothing new, but it comes back in the support which is given to the secessionist movement in Tibet, and it's used to destabilize China. I think another thing is all these military bases which surround. I'd be tempted to ask you a question. We've got four more minutes on the presidential elections. I know that you've written on this subject.
Well, the increased adoption of the primary system has led to an increased dependency on money. And I argue that we have three primaries, really. We have the voting primary, and then there's the money primary, and the media primary, where the media, we saw this with the Democrats, where the media designated the two front runners as being Obama and Clinton, and relegated other people to minor candidate status, including John Edwards, who grudgingly was then put in third place because he was leading in all the early polls as the one man who could defeat any Republican candidate. But instead they focused on the two candidates who do have major problems with the electorate. One is Hillary Clinton, who's first a woman, but also a candidate that a lot of people can't really warm up to. And then we have Barack Obama, who is partially of mixed race, which again stirs up some problems among the less enlightened elements in America, and whose only other national office was senator, as the same with Clinton. So this the media really often designates who the front runners are even before the campaigns have begun. And if they designate someone as a front runner, they did this, by the way, with Bill Clinton also. They designate him as a front runner, they start treating him that way. If they treat him that way, he gets all the front runner exposure, and people learn who he is and the name, and he does, in effect, become the front runner. And the money primary is another phenomenon we have here in the States. I remember years ago when candidates used to hide how much money they got from big contributors, and you know, keep quiet about that because it was an embarrassment. It showed you're taking big money, you owe big favors to the big money's interests. But now we have candidates, not just in the national elections, right here in California, a few state senators, they're getting up and saying, I've got $1 million in my war chest. That it now qualifies the person as a serious candidate, as a front-running candidate before even a vote has been cast. So you have this money primary also. It's a crazy system that's gotten even crazier.
I just wanted to ask a question because we're nearing the end of the program. Do you think that the Republicans have been, in a sense, raiding? I'm raiding the primaries in the broadest sense of the word, that they want to have weak candidates so that John McCain will come in.
Well, you mean Operation Chaos, where they entered the Pennsylvania Democratic primary? Maybe some did that. You know, Ron Paul was also running in the Pennsylvania primary, in the Republican primary, and did very well. He came in.
We're nearing the end of the program. This is Michelle Chosadowski with Michael Parenti. And we'll be back next week. Complete this program with an important question mark on the upcoming presidential elections. Men.